Council, as you're getting settled for our second case, I'll call the matter. It's A23-1534, Crow Wing Recycling and MPCA versus Northern Metals. Council, you're familiar with our procedures. You'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. The appellant has an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. These matters are being recorded. This is the only recording that is permitted. Please state your name and identify your client before you begin speaking. And take your time getting ready. We are ready whenever you are.
May it please the court, Jack Perry from the Taft Law Firm, and with me is Brianna Smith, also from the Taft Law Firm. Judge Frisch, I know we did this during COVID. I don't know if you guys are still doing it, but I think it would be helpful is to start out with 3 minutes of an overview of our argument before interruptions and questions. Would that be okay with the presiding judge?
We'll ask questions as we deem appropriate.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Based on the briefing, there are, before this court, just three issues, each of which is, however, a matter of first impression. To begin with the easiest, as the first of the three matters of first impression, the issue is whether, with regard to the district court's disqualification order as to the inadequate permit portion of count one, a Rule 1.9A disqualification can arise from a claim that is not and could not be against the new client. Other than the district court's disqualification order, there is literally no case in Minnesota or in the entire country, based on my research, that has disqualified a lawyer based on an alleged conflict regarding a claim not against the new client, not one. This is not surprising given that the plain language of Rule 1.9A, which requires material adversity, could not apply to a claim which is not and could not be against the new client. To proceed to the next easiest, as the second of the three matters of first impression, the issue is whether, with regard to the inadequate permit portion of counts one and three, the district court was required to determine its subject matter jurisdiction over the inadequate permit portion of counts one and three before it determined Northern Metals' disqualification motion.
Why would that be? I mean, district courts are courts of general jurisdiction, and even before you get to the merits, which is the subject matter of a claim, the district court has to determine whether counsel is disqualified from even representing a client in asserting a subject matter jurisdiction question. I don't understand why the district court is divested from jurisdiction in determining who appropriately is appearing in court. What if someone had no law license and showed up in court and wanted to argue on behalf of a corporation and wanted to argue a subject matter jurisdiction motion? Would the district court be able to say, I can't allow you to argue on behalf of a corporation, you're not a lawyer?
I don't know that answer, but I do know the answer.
I know that answer. I mean, you should know that answer.
I do know they answered the question you asked.
Yes.
And the Minnesota Supreme Court in Swanson v. 3M, 2014, said, in that case, we don't have any law on the issue of waiver. Here, you have no law in Minnesota. There is no case talking about who goes first. What goes first, subject matter jurisdiction motion or disqualification motion? But in 3M, it said, we looked at other jurisdictions. And so what you have before you, there are 10 reported cases on this very issue. What goes first? There are two federal circuit court cases, the 7th and the 5th, and there are 8 district court decisions, including ones in 2013, 2019, 2020. All of them, Judge Frisch, say the same thing. And they say the same thing is that
the principled basis why a district court judge should not be able to say who are disqualified from arguing whatever motion you bring, because there's a conflict of interest that is irreconcilable. Or you are disqualified from representing this client because you don't have a law license, right? You, I mean, I don't see even what the difference is there.
Well, these courts unanimously disagreed, and they give three reasons, Your Honor. And the district court judge agrees with you and said, no, you, we do this first.
I'm interested in hearing the reasons.
Yeah, and the first reason is, and I'm quoting, this is from what I think is the, it's a Seventh Circuit decision. Courts, quote, courts have regularly found that when faced with contemporaneous motions to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction and to disqualify an attorney, it is proper to decide the jurisdictional question first, end of quote. That's the Rice case.
Why?
Well, then the reason is, in the second reason, this is in the Jones case, the Dinger case, is in the absence of subject matter jurisdiction over the underlying action, this court lacks subject matter jurisdiction over a motion to disqualify counsel. Or stated otherwise, in the Dinger case, it says it would be inappropriate for this court to enter orders, even arguably a motion to disqualify an attorney. In fact, the Washington St. Tammany case said that where a court does not have subject matter jurisdiction, a motion to disqualify counsel is moot. In other words, you're focusing on the counsel. And what these courts all said is unanimously, and there is not a single case otherwise, is what they're concerned about is the court has to make sure it's following its ethical obligations, is it has to have subject matter jurisdiction. If it doesn't have subject matter jurisdiction, it can't rule on any motion.
But what has been appealed to us is whether the district court abused its discretion in disqualifying you. So how did the district court abuse its discretion? That's the issue that's before us. That's what the district court decided.
And subject matter jurisdiction under the Dennis Frenzen case, 1981 Supreme Court case, is subject matter jurisdiction cannot be waived. And so the issue of subject matter jurisdiction, which was raised as it relates to count one with the Dakota
raised
County.
Raised and not decided, raised and stayed. And now we're hearing the disqualification appeal. So why were you improperly disqualified?
Because every single case, all 10 reported cases that have addressed this issue said the district court didn't have authority to do anything until the district court first decides.
Mr. Perry, let's talk about your responsibility as far as Crow Wing and the information presented to Judge Diamond. A large part of your argument is that 5 years had passed from former representation to where we're at now. But the district court made a determination that regardless of the length of time, the question was whether confidential information was obsolete or not, and then pointed out that CWR identified no changes. None were identified in the technology, the legal, or the business environment. Tell us where in your brief or point us in the record where you have said that there has been some change in this information that would allow you to continue with representation.
The disqualification that the judge found was, he said, there is no disqualification as it relates to inadequate enforcement of the permit, which means count two and the second parts of count one and three, there's no disqualification. And that is our client, Crow Wing, in compliance with this permit or not? And if not, does MPCA have to take enforcement?
We're talking about representation.
Understand, okay. But there's only, the district court judge very carefully went through each of the three counts, and that has not been appealed. The analysis for disqualification is to go through each of the three counts. And as to those three counts,
there's an overlap. That's the question, right?
That's right. And he said there is no overlap as it relates to inadequate enforcement. So count two goes out, and the second half of counts one and three go out. He said there is an overlap between the inadequate permit portion of counts one and three. And here's where the jurisdiction question comes into play, is there is one case, it's a 2006 11th Circuit case, Sierra Club versus the Georgia Environmental Protection Agency. And in that case, they raised the plaintiff in that case raised the exact, Sierra Club, the same argument that Northern Metals is raising here. And they said that permit is inadequate, that Clean Air Act. And what the 11th Circuit said is, court, you don't have any jurisdiction over that because that claim can only be brought against the EPA because the EPA controls all air permits. That's the argument we have, is this court, Judge District Court, did not then, does not now, based on his interpretation, which is different than both parties, neither party thought the claims being made were about inadequate permit. They disavowed that in their briefing. And so the judge came up with this, but that basis upon which he found a disqualifying conflict raises the issue of subject matter jurisdiction, and there's only one case in the record, only one case in the country that addresses it and says he has no jurisdiction, and it makes sense because it's a Clean Air Act issue that is all controlled by the EPA, not by the MPCA. And so we are in front of, as to that issue, we're in front of the wrong court, and as to the rest of the claim, the judge said there's no conflict. And so that's what's exasperating is he created a characterization of the claims that were made different than what the plaintiffs or the metals raised, and created an issue that had we known that was his issue, we would have said you can't do that, which is what we're raising now. There is no jurisdiction over that issue. You look at me like
I am, because I feel your argument strays off of what we're looking at as an appellate body, and that's the simple disqualification. And we look at the rule, we apply the rule to the situation here, and in my opinion, I think you need to present us with information as to whether counts 1 and 3, whether there was not any overlap with your prior representation. I think that's your duty and your job, and I'm just asking for you to point out to me that either it was public knowledge by the time we've gotten to this point, or that it's well known by everyone. That would, I don't want to use the eradicate, but that would lessen the overlap, and that's what I want you to tell me. If I've missed it in the record, I'll be happy to go back and look, but I don't see that you've pointed out the differences in terms of where your prior representation and current representation.
Judge Werke, with all due respect here, is that I'm doing exactly what the defending law firm did in the 3M, the Swanson v. 3M case. The issue there was waiver, and there was no evidence in the record about waiver. The district court ruled, and the court of appeals affirmed, that waiver, you can't waive attorney-client privileges in this context. And the Supreme Court disagreed with that and then remanded it to go back and deal with the issue of waiver, which is what they did. That's what I'm asking you to do, is that the district court, erroneously, according to every single appellate court that's addressed that, has said, and the plain language of Rule 1.9a, has said that you have to decide jurisdiction, and he doesn't have jurisdiction over the inadequate permit portion of counts 1 and 3.
But he didn't exercise jurisdiction over that. I mean, I understand your argument a little clearer today, and that is you're claiming that the district court had to dip its toe into the subject matter of the action in order to disqualify you, and that's improper. Is that your argument, really?
Exactly. I mean, that's what everyone in these other cases have said. They've said you have to address that first.
But it doesn't appear to me that the district court is actually exercising subject matter or jurisdiction over the subject matter of the claims. It is exercising its authority as a judicial body to determine who appropriately may appear in court, which is a different question, regardless of the subject matter of the dispute. I think those are different questions, and I'm not hearing a reason articulate. I didn't see it in the cases, and I'm not hearing a reason from you why those aren't two different things.
Because I don't believe that construct is correct, is that the Ethics Board has separate jurisdiction over compliance or noncompliance with the rules. The district court's authority in this case is its jurisdiction. If it doesn't have subject matter jurisdiction, it can't make any rulings, whether it's our Rule 12 on the pleadings motions, whether it's disqualification motions, no authority, period. And that's what these cases talk about, every one of them. And there is no citation from the other side on this that says, oh no, the court has subject matter jurisdiction over disqualification first. No, it doesn't. There is no case that says that. The only jurisdiction, Judge Diamond, who I love, The only jurisdiction he has is if he has it under these four counts, or three counts, excuse me. If he doesn't, he can't make any ruling. And then the issue is, once he has subject matter jurisdiction, then we turn to the next issue, which is also debated in the case law, which is he has to rule based on the case law on the subject matter jurisdiction first. If he does that, this case goes away, as this qualification goes away. Alternatively, under the California case, there's a case called New England Wire Technology. It's an April 27, 2023 case. Again, New England Wire Technology v. Cooner, C-O-O-N-E-R. And it says, goes beyond, Judge Frisch, what you're asking me about subject matter jurisdiction. It says, it rejected the Northern Metals argument on the Sixth Circuit, this Bowers case. It said, hey, you can't do anything as it relates to dispositive motions until you first do disqualification. The California court last year rejected that and said, no. The same reason why we don't spell, I'm sorry, can I finish that?
You can finish it.
The same reason why we don't try to prescribe all the different scenarios for Rule 1.9a or any of the rules is we give discretion to the district court. And the California said, you don't want to have a strict rule that says, no, we're not going to look at that. Because of this very scenario that we have here, where we are being disqualified based upon a claim that is not, could not be against us, count one, and count three, which according to the Supreme Court in 2020, and their admission, cannot be maintained against us. How in the world can a party be disqualified based upon that? Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for a respondent, whenever you're ready.
May it please the court, counsel, Patrick O'Neill on behalf of Northern Metals. With me today is Mr. Matt Bolt. I just listened to the 15 minutes about the three issues. I think, you know, I would submit this is a single issue, whether or not the trial court abused its discretion in the findings of fact made in applying Rule 1.9. 1.9 is a pretty straightforward rule, as is the test outlined in Swanson versus 3M. But before we get into that test, I want to talk about the inherent power of the trial courts. And all three of you were trial court judges. You have jurisdiction to hear a disqualification motion. And the inherent power of the trial courts regulates our lawyers. I'm here today after spending 30 years kind of policing our profession, if you will. And I think that heart of this case is a lot about preserving client confidences. And what is the inherent power of the trial court is to regulate lawyers. Think about the Supreme Court, how it regulates lawyers, this court, trial courts. There's also an inherent power about the integrity of this proceeding. We don't want taint. We don't want a stench coming in from 4 years of the prior lawyer. And a client shouldn't have to sit and wonder if their client confidence is going to be used to advance the new client. And I think that is some of the bedrock of why we're here, the sanctity of the attorney-client relationship. As a court, you want to promote the public having trust in our system, and you want to promote the public from sharing client confidences and knowing they'll be safeguarded. Now, subject matter jurisdiction and where Mr. Perry, a worthy adversary, wants to take you. I would respectfully submit, don't go there, because Judge Diamond stayed the merits. And where do you get that as special proceeding? You get that from the Janicek case.
To be fair to Mr. Perry's position, I think what he's claiming is that for Judge Diamond to effect the disqualification order, the district court necessarily had to dip its toe into the subject matter of the underlying dispute, and that is somehow prohibited when there is a pending motion to dismiss for subject matter jurisdiction, and that required the district court to decide that issue first.
Yeah, we just disagree.
I mean, tell me why.
Because Janicek case is a special proceeding. A motion to disqualify is a special proceeding independent of the merits. Okay? The action of court independent of the merits of the underlying action. And that's on 610 Northwest 2nd, 638, 642. And that's what presents an appellate issue. We're up here on 103G because you can appeal. You can appeal a disqualification. A lawyer can. I'm not exactly sure he's been disqualified. Is he here on behalf of Crow Wing? Is he here on behalf of Taft? Is he here on behalf of both? You have a disqualified lawyer. Right now he's disqualified, making arguments in front of you. Now, certainly on Swanson, he can do that. But, you know, Crow Wing is making this subject matter jurisdiction from a disqualified lawyer. Now, you know, think about the practicality, okay? You're going to hear a motion on the merits from somebody who's disqualified or maybe. Don't abandon the practicality of trying to say you got to hear this first before you can do this. The practicality is they answered. They're a party. They made a motion. He appeared, okay? He argued. There was a decision, a jurisdiction, and discretion. I'm going to stay this over here. They can raise subject matter jurisdiction later. And all these cases, you know, the federal cases, it's not a constitutional court. I mean, the state court is not an Article III judge. So there's the federal cases. Was it contemporaneous? Did he even argue, judge, you need to decide subject matter before you can disqualify me? No. It was never argued. So My respectful suggestion is the judge had independent jurisdiction. A disqualification motion can be heard at any time. It's independently appealable. And that was perfectly within his discretion to not to go there with the subject matter. And by the way, 116B 1.10 is a direct action statute. So if you are going to go down this road, which I encourage you not to, it's a direct action statute. Some of the cases cited don't even have the similar statute to us. Judge Diamond went into why this is permitted. Derivative claims are permitted. They're named as a party. They answered. They tried to stay it where it may come back to him. The laundry list is long on our unique statute that Northern Metals can do this as a way to promote a level playing field. I want to get into the test before we get too bogged down with jurisdiction, and that was longer than I wanted to spend. But 1.9 is three-part test. First of all, was there an attorney-client relationship that's been conceded? Clearly, they represented Northern Metals. But I just want to make clear that it was not a New York minute. It's not a New York minute representation, if you know what I mean by that. Some cases, well, you represented me on this isolated thing, disqualification. 4 years, significant fees, lobbying, permitting process, vigorous litigation.
Counsel, the district court made a determination that disqualification was not appropriate for count two.
Right.
And yet the firm was disqualified for count two as right. well. What's the basis for that, and why is that not an abuse of discretion?
I'll answer that. First of all, you look at the rule and it says on a matter. Okay, so it's is there a conflict of interest on the matter? He did go into the factual overlap and the legal issue overlap. And in doing that, very thoroughly, he went count by count. But just because he found no overlap or conflict on count two doesn't mean they stay in the case. You don't have a situation where You get to stay in the case on count two, but you're disqualified on counts one and three.
Why?
So
just to
why?
Be clear about your response, I mean, it's sort of a why. So it is your response that the district court's decision to take this count-by-count approach is just illustrative of the sort of careful analysis that the district court did in determining whether they were disqualified from the entire matter and nothing more than that?
I mean, yeah,
is that
I mean,
what
I think
saying?
Yes. I mean, I think it's as a whole, and he went through. Is the Swanson versus 3M says you have to go through the factual and legal overlap. So he went, what are the issues in counts one and three? And he made specific findings on counts one and three on why there's an overlap, and that's on page 24 and 25. And those are detailed findings. I mean, it's a overlap on measurement, monitoring, abatement, recycling facility emissions. And then he went to the issue, okay? And this is the one that the heart of the lawsuit is whether or not the competitive environment is being fairly maintained by the regulator with the backdrop of what is in the best interest of land, air, and water. The only issue is not whether they comply with its permit, count two. It's about the adequacy of option D. Option D, the lowest level required permit, is what Crow Wing has. We have a higher one. And he made that finding on page three. But all of these are, the factual overlap and the legal issue overlap are all backed up, and they're findings of fact, of which he didn't abuse his discretion in doing. So as a whole, it's the matter. And you can't be in on one count and be qualified on counts one and three. That would make no sense. It would make no practical sense. It's a matter as a whole. They're a party. They answered. They appeared. And so I think, frankly, you know, he says we didn't appeal count two. We didn't have to appeal that he ruled on count two that way. You know, I submit it shows the thoroughness that whether they violated the option D permit is not, you know, there's no overlap there.
Why isn't the remedy to bifurcate the proceedings? So you bifurcate counts one and three from count two.
You know, I would just say that's very impractical. Mr. Perry has confidential information that may be used to advance his current client's interest. And let's get to that a minute, okay? So in the case law and the comment, you say to yourself, okay, is there a factual and legal overlap? Yes. Is the confidential information presumed? Yes. Has it been rebutted? No. He made specific findings of fact that it's not rebutted. But you also look at the rule and it says, is there a substantial risk that this confidential information for 4 years on every aspect of our company is going to be used to advance Crow Wing's interests? And he found that to be yes. And it's not close. That substantial risk is why we're here. And that's what we can't allow. Someone who has got as much information as he has. It's a very bright line rule. And we're not going to sit and wonder. Think about this. We're going to wonder if he's going to use something he learned about our experts, about our emissions, when we're comparing. There's a lot of other lawyers that could handle this case. And the waiver issue that he brings up in Swanson versus 3M is because they waited, okay? They waited to disqualify until later. We did not wait. We were, frankly, shocked when our former lawyer, who's got our name on his website and still has our file, goes and files an answer that's adverse to us. This isn't a waiver issue like in Swanson at all. This is a former lawyer who has jumped over to our competitor, and he has confidential information found by the judge. Now, the test talks about presumption. He asked for a hearing. The law does not require a hearing here because the way they've set it up is we don't have to present all the confidential information. It's presumed. And then what is the, you know, questions are, well, did you rebut the presumption that you have it? And the court went through that. And they actually looked at time entries showing the Becker facility. Time entries on option D, the same exact option D permit, researching and advising us when we're paying them, it's now at this issue, okay? Judge Diamond looked at all that and he said, overlap. This is overlap.
So Judge Diamond also found that the presumption had not been rebutted. Is that a factual finding?
I submit, yes. That is a finding of fact that's supported by the evidence. Page 18 of his order. Crow Wing has not offered substantial evidence rebutting this presumption. Based upon the evidence in the record, I would submit that's not been rebutted. In fact, there's a 122-paragraph affidavit from Mr. Perry that he actually says this shows the deep knowledge. It shows the vigorous litigation. He said it's on page 18, again, that Taft offered no meaningful rebuttal on access to experts and experts' opinions and their thought processes. And then he says that it leads to an overlap. High-level access. They had high-level access to all our people and all our, so no hearing was necessary. Now, in Swanson, they also talk about other relevant circumstances, and one of the reasons it was remanded was because the trial court did not go into the other relevant circumstances, but Judge Diamond did. And he asked, is this in the public record? Mr. Perry argued, it's in the public record. And Judge Diamond looked at that and said, it's not in the public record. And not everything you learn from your client doesn't end up in a public filing, not to state the obvious. But that's what he found, a finding of fact. They also looked at, is it obsolete? And he, again, looked at it, dug into it, and said, the information is not obsolete. Same regulatory agency, same metal shredding, same permitting process. Nothing has changed. Materially changed to make the information obsolete. So I have 10 seconds left. To conclude, the trial court did not abuse his discretion in applying 1.9 and the Swanson test. It's a very thorough and well thought out order, and for those reasons we submit should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. Anything else from the panel?
No.
Thank you very much, counsel. Mr. Perry, whenever you're ready.
Jack Perry again on for the reply.
Would you comment on the fact that count two was determined not to be a conflict and how that would intermesh with a potential bifurcation or how you could represent on that count alone singularly?
Yeah, and we raised that in an argument. There is literally no case law on that anywhere in the country. And so your question, Judge Fish, is you're ahead of everyone else. No one has talked about that.
I mean, it's a discretionary decision by the district court, obviously.
Yeah. Now, in this case, it becomes wildly important for this reason, is that worst case scenario, we are disqualified as to one and three. Substitute counsel comes in, and the first thing that's happened is count one is going to be, it's going to be clarified that we're not part of it, and count three, we're going to be dismissed because they've admitted it can't be against us. You cannot bring a public trust doctrine case against anyone besides the state of Minnesota. In 2020, in the White Bear Lake restoration case, that's what the Supreme Court said. They didn't dispute that. So we're going to be thrown out as it relates to one and three. One, we're diving against us, and three will be thrown out. And so the only thing left then is count two. And once the claims that are at issue, according to Judge Diamond, one and three are thrown out, then there is no disqualifying conflict. And so the issue is, what do you do in the meantime if we go there, is really important. Which gets to what the California, this New England case was so striking to me, because it gets to the practical questions all three of you are asking. And the reason I jump back to Swanson is they said, we don't have much case law as it relates to disqualification. And yet it's super important. Client confidence are super important. But also, the Swanson Court talked about the concern about using and weaponizing disqualification motions. So how do we balance that? And that's what the New England case said is, hey, we're not going to have these bright line rules that are easy for the district court judges, but they're not fair. And they said, no, we're going to give the discretion to the district court judges and give them very fair warning. You cannot compromise the client confidences, and we have not. But you also have to make sure that the attorney's rights are protected. So I go back to that case because that creates the practical solution is you give it to the district court. In this case, the district court said, I don't have discretion to look at jurisdiction. I don't have, and that's for count one because that was before him at the time. And I don't have discretion to look at the our Rule 12 on the pleadings motions.
Mr. O'Neill suggested that you really aren't even in a position as a party now for the purpose of arguing regarding your own disqualification to make arguments that go to the merits of the case, such as the jurisdiction argument. What's your response to that?
Crazy. The first issue that was resolved in the 3M, the Swanson 3M case, is that very issue, is does the lawyer have a right on behalf of a client, on behalf of themselves, to appeal a disqualification motion? And the court said, yes. No exception, no qualifications, no nothing. And I am advancing the merits arguments, the Rule 12 and the subject matter, only as it relates to what the district court's obligation was to do, which is to look at subject matter jurisdiction first, and also, under the California case, to also look, have the discretion. He didn't think he had the discretion, but I think this court needs to clarify, you do have discretion, because it in this case, the district court could have very, very easily, since they didn't bring a case against us under count one, and they can't maintain a claim against us in count three, and those are only disqualifying conflict issues, he could have immediately, if he thought he had that discretion, he could have immediately gotten rid of this qualifying conflict, and we could have moved forward, and we wouldn't have to bifurcate and do all this jicky-jack stuff. And so that's what this case is wildly important from client confidence's point of view and also the lawyer's point of view, and we're in the exact same position we were back in 2014 on the waiver issue, is we have issues of first impression that have to be resolved. And
what about the argument that you forfeited that issue?
Subject matter jurisdiction under the Frenzen case, which I cited to, you cannot forfeit subject matter jurisdiction.
So it's not a problem that you never mentioned this in the district court?
Well, I did mention it as to count one, to be clear. I brought a 12.03 on the pleadings motion against count one, and they argued, well, you don't have standing because we weren't a party. And now, ironically, they're trying to say, no, you're disqualified because of a count that you didn't have standing for. It's crazy. And as it relates to count three, is we also brought that, and we filed our motions first for the dismissal.
You can finish your thought.
Okay, counsel. I'm sorry. Guys, we also addressed that. We had a Rule 12.02E motion that was filed before the disqualification motion as it relates to count three as well. That we weren't a party, and it's not a cognizable claim.
Anything else from the panel?
No.
Thank you very much, counsel. Thank you very much, counsel, for your arguments this morning. The matter is submitted, and you will receive an opinion within the statutory time period. Thank you.
Thank you very much.